Okay, we're going to dive in rapidly this morning so I can cover as many items as I can in the allotted time we have. We're going to be looking at the final plank in our tower we've been building this weekend on looking at the creation model and building that systematically. I began talking about this Bill Nye Ken Ham debate yesterday, and so there were several challenges that Bill Nye brought up that are very relevant in trying to defend the biblical creation model. And so I wanted to look at some of those points that he made that Ken Ham did not address, which I thought were some great points that needed to be addressed. These are some of those points that he brought up. How can it be that there are hundreds of thousands of years worth of ice layering in the ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica if the Earth is only a few thousand years old? How can we have trees that are older than the flood and even creation in some cases? How can you have civilizations with histories that go back before the flood rather than beginning at Babel? How can you get animals to Australia after the flood? If all of the animals are killed, how do you get them from the ark to Australia? How can you have a relatively small number of species on the ark, say 7,000, and then get from that to 16 million today? That would be the equivalent of 11 new species coming about every day over 4,000 years since the flood. How do you even get all of these species on the ark? How can the ark be big enough? And then he cited the Wyoming as an example of a large wooden vessel that was not seaworthy. It ultimately sank due to the tendency of its planks to twist and buckle and cause leakage. And so he said, the ark is even much bigger than that. So how could the ark be seaworthy? So let's go ahead and zoom through these, and we'll hit some others after that if we have time. So the first quibble there that I wanted to address, how can you have hundreds of thousands of years worth of layering in the ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica? And obviously the first thing that we need to understand is what is an ice core? This is where they'll drill down, take a tube of ice up out of the ground, out of the ice caps, and you'll see these layers of ice that are annual layers. Okay, and so he's saying we got evidence of hundreds of thousands of years worth of these layers when we pull up these ice cores. So how do we respond to that? Well, I've talked a lot this weekend about uniformitarianism being a fundamental assumption of the evolutionary model, and this can be shown to be a terrible assumption with actual physical evidence today in many places. The idea is whatever rates you see going on today, the assumption is they've always been that way throughout geologic time. So if you see these layers forming annually, then they've always formed annually, and therefore it takes hundreds of thousands of years for these to form. Now the response is, what if uniformitarianism is not correct? And I made the point to you that we can know the Bible's from God because it has supernatural characteristics, which means there was a global flood, which means uniformitarianism is not right. Catastrophic events have happened in the past that have to be taken into account. In this case, if more than one layer of ice can be laid down in a single year, it would destroy the assumption that ice cores can be used to prove that the Earth is hundreds of thousands of years old. And sure enough, that evidence actually exists when you look at the physical evidence. We know that individual storms and cyclical weather patterns can cause multiple layers in a single year that resemble annual layers. And so yesterday I talked about the Ice Age as being an important part of the creation model, and that the Ice Age provides the perfect circumstances for multiple layers of ice being formed every year during these few hundred years that the Ice Age was taking place. In fact, creation meteorologists estimate as many as 1,000 annual cycles of ice were forming each year during this Ice Age period. But even modern estimates of ice accumulation in Greenland are less than 1 foot per year, right? Less than 1 foot of ice forming per year. But even in modern times, we have examples of rapid deposition of ice that doesn't fit that uniformitarian assumption. For example, in 1990 or 1988, ground-penetrating radar was used to discover the location of some abandoned World War II planes from 1942 in Greenland. And surprisingly, the planes had been buried under more than 260 feet of ice and snow in that amount of time. Now, that's the equivalent of over 5 feet of ice forming every year for 46 years, rather than modern estimates of less than 1 foot per year. So notice, even in modern times, uniformitarian estimates for ice layers don't coincide with the actual observable evidence when you get in the field. So Bill Nye's use of ice cores to try to prove an old Earth simply doesn't hold water, doesn't hold ice under scrutiny. All right, Bill Nye argued there are bristlecone pine trees alive today that are as much as 6,800 years old, and even pointed at a Norway spruce tree called Chico that is thought to be 9,550 years old. If so, these trees would have had to survive the flood and possibly even precede the creation week, which would be a major problem for the biblical creation model if true. So first of all, we have to understand, if you want to understand tree dating, you have to understand what dendrochronology is. And so this is the idea of studying tree rings and their pattern, the patterns of tree rings, to try to understand things about the past, not just the age of a tree, but also you can tell things about climate and so forth in the past based on the nature of these tree rings. Now, he mentioned old bristlecone pine trees as being 6,000 to 7,000 years old. And the first thing you have to ask is, what bristlecone pine trees are, is if he's talking about one in particular, what's he talking about? This is a common issue. If you're dealing with a skeptic or an atheist, you need to ask them to prove their point. You know, be specific. What are you talking about? The oldest living bristlecone pine tree was discovered in 2012 and dated as 5,062 years old using tree ring counting and cross dating. So 5,062 years old, which means that it started growing around 3,000 BC, if we assume that that dating is correct. So is that a problem for the creation model? Well, it sounds like it. If you have a tree older than when the flood was supposed to occur, the biblical model places the flood as recent as 2,300 BC, based on the chronologies of Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, coupled with history. So that would be only 4,300 years ago. But, as I mentioned yesterday, there is room to expand that number by several years in the chronologies of Genesis 11, and I cited our website for articles on that subject. So this already eliminates the problem that Bill Nye is asserting, but we also have to consider that, once again, uniformity is assumed in tree ring dating. The assumption is that you've got one ring forming each year, but we know today that rings don't always correlate with single years. Sometimes rings can form subannually. When you have time staggered, repeated disturbances that are caused by, guess what, unusual weather patterns, for example, then this has been shown to severely affect tree ring patterns. And so again, we look at the importance of having a good biblical model, and we see that the ice age is a critical part of the biblical model. You've got this ensuing during the formative years of the oldest trees. This would have caused repeated major storms and atmospheric disturbances for many years. So the circumstances were perfect for the creation of multiple annual tree rings within a single year. So it's very possible that the bristlecone pines are actually several years younger than they appear. So where did he even get 6,800 as opposed to 5,062 as the age of the oldest bristlecone? Well, it's unclear because, again, he's not specific. He just throws that out there and doesn't prove it. So you end up having to make the case for him. Is he actually meaning that we're not talking about living trees? Are we talking about dead trees that have been cross-dated? This is where dendrochronologists will successively overlap tree ring patterns from living and dead trees, sometimes even petrified trees, to get a tree history further back in history. But as you can imagine, this is an imprecise and oftentimes even a subjective way of dating. We've got trees that are today in the same forest that don't always have the same tree ring patterns, because this is a complex equation here that's affected by the distance from the water, a water source that the tree is, the direction of the sunlight, the soil nutrients where the tree is, storm patterns. But it's argued that you can get a date back over 8,000 years ago successive tree life going back that far. So if the flood is 4,000 to 5,500 years ago, That would sound like a problem for the flood model, but notice it's only potentially a problem if we assume that all trees could not survive the flood, and that's an assumption. The text says all flesh died that moved on the earth, chapter 7, verse 21, not plants. Some areas of the planet may have had less turbulence. Some trees could have been more robust due to the optimized nature of the pre-flood environment. We would not even estimate that the entire earth was completely flooded and at its peak level until several months into the flood. Bert Craig of the Department of Horticulture and Forestry at Michigan State, he even comes out and says, you know, we've got many tree species we know that can survive months underwater in flood conditions. Horticulturalist Whitlow and Harris produced a monumental work on the effect of flooding on trees, and they documented dozens of species that are able to survive deep flooding for one growing season and even for more than 1 year. And so if trees survived the flood, either because they survived being underwater or because they were brought onto the ark with Noah, then trees with over 6,000 rings even would not be a problem. So that said, even if cross-dating could legitimately take you back thousands of years further than the flood and even further than creation, it's still not a problem because we have to keep in mind that God created the earth with an appearance of age, which remember I also included in the model yesterday when talking about the creation week. So I mentioned that Adam and Eve were not fetus whenever they were created. They already had an immediate appearance of age. And in fact, Adam was able to tend the garden, name the animals, they could procreate, things that would have taken years and years under a natural growing type system. And yet there was an immediate mature creation. Starlight from distant stars would already be in place in order to fulfill the purpose that God had for those, as stated there in Genesis 1. We would expect there to be daughter elements and parent elements already in any rocks, which means your radiometric dating techniques would be faulty from the very beginning. And we would expect there to be tree rings in any of the trees in the Garden of Eden, because as I mentioned yesterday, tree rings, the purpose of tree rings is not to give you an age of the tree. It provides strength to a tree as it gets bigger. Those rings are needed to sustain massive trees, and so you'd expect tree rings in any of the trees of the garden. Or what about the Norway spruce Old Chico, which he did mention specifically, that's thought to be 9,550 years old? The problem here is he used carbon dating. This was not dated even using dendrochronology, and so it's not even typically listed among the verified oldest trees. C14 dating is notoriously imprecise and suspect beyond a few thousand years, caused in large part due to its foundational assumptions concerning the effect of the Earth's magnetic field on the production rate of C14. And the assumption is that the ratio of C14 to C12 in the atmosphere has remained constant throughout history, which the secular scientists now reject. Archaeologist Brian Fagan of UC Santa Barbara even came out and said carbon dating is not infallible. In general, single dates should not be trusted. You can't even trust a date of C14 with a single date. I would say even more than just one C14 measurement is not going to provide what you need beyond about 1,000 to 1,500 BC. Then we know the decay rates have been accelerated beyond up from there up to the flood, which means any dating of using C14 is going to be off. So tree ages simply can't be used to disprove the creation model. Number three, according to Bill Nye, he says, you know, there are human populations that are far older than the flood, with traditions that go back further than that. All right, so if that's true, that would seem to contradict the biblical text, because all civilizations were annihilated in the flood. Only those civilizations that emerged after the flood, and specifically after Babel, should have distinct traditions that keep going back. Well, again, we have to ask, what civilization is he talking about? He doesn't get specific. He just throws it there and expects us to make the case for him. So we're left to guess and make this argument. Is he talking about China? China has records that go back to 1600 BC. Beyond that, it's just uncorroborated legend that exists before that. Chinese history cannot be said to pose a problem for the creation model. Is he talking about the Sumerians? 2700 BC is the date for the earliest known Sumerian king. The Sumerian language is said to be the oldest written language, and it's claimed to date back to 3100 BC. But according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the chronology of the first half of the third millennium is largely a matter for the intuition of the individual author. Carbon 14 dates are at present too few and far between to be given undue weight. Consequently, the turn of the fourth to the third millennium is to be accepted with due caution and reservations as the date of the invention of writing. So even the date of 3100 BC is speculative, and even if it's right, it still falls after possible flood date estimates, which can be as high as 3500 BC or more. What about Egypt? Scholars consider 3100 BC to be the commencement of the first Egyptian dynasty, and again, that can't be known conclusively for the same reasons as Sumer, especially due to the inexact nature of tree ring dating, pottery comparison, C14 dating, and historical records. Some scholars believe that date can be collapsed a few hundred more years into the 2000s BC. Again, either way, all of these dates from China, Sumer, Egypt can fit within the biblical time frame. So bottom line, Bill Nye's claims here don't carry any weight. They don't disprove the biblical model. But I do notice an interesting pattern here. The oldest living tree dates back to about 3100 BC. The Egyptian dynasty goes back to about 3100 BC. The origin of the written language in Sumer goes back to about 3100 BC, with no verifiable civilizations before that time. Now, this is exactly what we would predict if the flood happened. Something significant seems to have happened immediately prior to this time period. The post-story of the flood is being verified from multiple independent directions. All right, number four, if there was a flood, how do you get the animals to Australia once they left the ark? Right, you got Australia way out there, away from any continent. Any animal that was on the ark or on Australia before the flood would have been killed. So how do the animals get to Australia from the ark after the flood? All right, number one, you got to keep in mind, if this is a problem for creationists, guess who it's also a problem for? The evolutionists. How do you get to Australia, period? Evolutionists would be in a quandary trying to assert that animals in Australia evolved completely separately from their own single-celled organism that separately sprang to life hundreds of millions of years ago and evolved into kangaroos. So the question is, how do you get animals there, even if you're an evolutionist? Well, whatever you come up with, why wouldn't the same argument be relevant to creationists? Number two, while Bill Nye summarily dismissed the idea of a land bridge from Asia to Australia without any thought, you actually will notice there are islands along the path from China to Australia, and the water between those islands can be misleading because it hides what's really under there. And even some models say that this is how kangaroos got to Australia, even secular models. So notice from this map of the Pacific Sea floor that the continental shelf of China actually extends all the way down to the continental shelf of Australia, with only a relatively small gap between the two. And again, you got to keep in mind what the biblical model claims. We would say there's lower waters during the Ice Age period because you've got more ice at the poles. So these continents could have even once touched or been very close to it, making travel from one area to the other feasible. And again, also I talked yesterday as a part of the model, the idea that, you know, we don't have a problem with Pangaea and before that, Rodinia, the idea that the continents that were at one time crammed together into one supercontinent. So they were once together and have since moved apart, and immediately after the flood, they would have been much closer. I remember concerning the origin of dry land in Genesis 1:9, God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place. Let the dry land appear." So doesn't that imply if all the waters gathered together, then the land is as well, which gives rise to this idea of a supercontinent. Remember Genesis 7:11 says all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, the windows of heaven were open. And so I talked about catastrophic plate tectonics and the evidence that we have that supports that from modern geology. So again, the uniformitarian assumption is the key to understanding continental drift from a creationist perspective. Today, the continents are moving apart on the order of centimeters per year, so basically as fast as your fingernails are growing. But during and immediately after the flood, they were moving quickly. We're talking on the order of meters per second. And so where we have a rapid drift instead of a continental drift. It's more like continental sprint going on during and after the flood. And interestingly, recent research by Yale University geologists provides evidence for the claim that the movement of the continents was much faster, in fact, at least three times faster than it is today. And so they said from their research, these observations suggest that either non-uniformitarian plate tectonics or an episode of rapid true polar wonder occurred during, notice, the Cambrian explosion of animal life. So notice two things about their study. Number one, it provides evidence that substantiates the creation model's prediction that the movement of the continents was once much faster. And number two, it highlights the fact that this accelerated movement occurred in the same time period as the catastrophic event that caused the Cambrian explosion. And guess what the Cambrian explosion is to creationists? I talked about that yesterday. That is the beginning of the flood. And so bottom line, if the continents were together and much closer to one another during and after the flood, then moving animals from one continent to another wouldn't be insurmountable. But there's other options for the creation model as well. It's possible that the post-flood ice age could have allowed migration across frozen channels. Another plausible option, there would have been no doubt the pre-flood forests would have been floating on these receding waters of the earth for some time after the flood, which would have created small land masses for travel across channels. This is a picture from 2012 of Spirit Lake near Mount St. Helens. This is 32 years after the big 1980 eruption. And notice the floating log mat from that catastrophic event that is still there. This image is from the Telegraph, which is a popular newspaper out of the UK. And notice the title of the article that contained this picture, "Massive Floating Rubbish Islands from Japan Tsunami Are Spotted on the Pacific." And that's what they look like. This is what happens after you have catastrophic activity. Here's a shot of the island floating across the Pacific towards the U.S. West Coast. This particular debris island was 69 miles in length. It covered an expanse of over 2.2 million square feet. Notice this picture. In the description, it explains that members of the Japan Coast Guard found and rescued that dog in the picture from a debris island from that tsunami 3 weeks after the tsunami. The dog was out there for 3 weeks on this rubbish island, and he survived. They rescued him. So it's not at all outlandish to suppose that massive debris islands would have been found worldwide after the flood, and that you could have even spotted animals on some of those in the years immediately after the flood. And as added evidence of the legitimacy of that model, recent genetic analysis suggests that the marsupials, including the kangaroos, originated in South America before moving to Australia. And this is what the secular guys are saying. So when you look at the projections of what the ocean currents would have likely looked like during the Paleocene and the Oligocene periods immediately after the flood, we see that there would have likely been an ocean current moving straight from South America over to Australia. And so ocean currents are argued to be how various creatures got from South America to the famous Galapagos Islands Darwin studied. So this is an option, again, that even the evolutionists don't have a problem with. If a tsunami in just one small area of the world could make these floating islands of debris and trees, then why wouldn't a global flood create similar and even more substantial islands of debris like these depicted in this painting by Louis Lavoie that illustrated our Dinosaurs Unleashed book? Of course, one final possibility as to how animals got to Australia is that humans could have carried them. Now, that's not something that they would consider, but that's something we don't have a problem with, because humans were around at the same time as all these creatures and could have just brought them with them. I don't know about you, but I'd kind of like to have a kangaroo to carry around. That'd be kind of cool. So anyway, granted, this option isn't available for again, evolutionists, but it's not a problem for the biblical creation model. All right, number five, this was an interesting point he brought up. He said, we've got 16 million species today, and yet if there's only 7,000 species on the ark 4,000 years ago, then that would mean 11 completely new species are emerging every day since the flood. That sounds pretty unrealistic, right? And I got to admit, when he said that, I was like, oh, man, that's an interesting point. It seems like that 4,000 years is just not enough time to give rise to the kind of diversity we see today. All right, so again, you start digging in to figure out what's going on here. So first of all, keep in mind He is correct in his representation of one thing about the flood model. We don't claim that all current species were on the ark. Not all the variety that you see today was on the ark. Not all, for example, the dogs that you see today. Remember, species is a modern concept. I talked about this yesterday in developing the creation model as well. We argue what the text says. The different kinds of animals were on the ark, not species. Genesis 6:20. So, for example, you picture a representative of the dog kind from which came your domestic dog breeds that we have today, as well as maybe the wolves, foxes, coyotes. There was probably a cat kind and horse kind, elephant kind, bear kind, and so forth on the ark. So something more like the modern taxonomic category of family or genus. And so there's no need to fit every single modern species on the ark, which would be difficult, if not impossible, but there's no need to, since many different species within a kind could come about through microevolutionary processes after the floods. So we're not talking about macro, which is what Darwin argued for, where a dinosaur could turn into a bird. No, that's two totally different kinds of creature. We're talking about variation within the kind. You don't look like your parents, right? There's differences. So we're talking microevolutionary change. So there would have been representatives from each of the kinds that had the genetic material within them to produce the diversity of creatures we see today within those kinds. So it's true from those original few kinds, the proto-species on the ark, all of the current land and creeping thing species would have emerged through some kind of microevolutionary process. And so under the flood model, we have to be able to explain how you can get from those initial few species to the tremendous variety we see today in just a few thousand years. All right, now Bill Nye said there were 7,000 proto-species on the ark, and he said he'd been quoting Ken Ham. We don't really know if it was 7,000 original species. That's actually something that creation scientists are looking into in studying baraminology. It could have been more, it could have been less, but for the sake of argument, we'll give that to him. So he says, so you'd go out into your yard and you wouldn't just find a different bird, a new bird. You'd find a different kind of bird, a whole new species of bird every day. This would be enormous news. I mean, the last 4,000 years, people would have seen these changes among us. We see no evidence of that. There's no evidence of these species. All right, so let's look into it. In response, first of all, we'd like to know again, where did he get his number of 16 million as the number of species today? There is a lot of disagreement about how many species there are today, but that number is extremely high. Some estimates are as low as 2 million, including an estimate published by Science Magazine in 2013. One study from 2011 that seems to be pretty well researched and accepted by many, so much so that it was published in the Public Library of Science Biology. It estimated not 16 million, but 10,960,000. But that estimate included not only the kingdom Animalia, but plantae, fungi, protozoa, chromista, archaea, and even bacteria. And so keep in mind that these are also estimates. The actual catalog number of species on the planet 2011 was only 1,438,769. They're projecting that eventually they're going to find close to 11 million. All right, now Bill Nye needs to be sure to accurately reflect what the biblical model claims. From this 11 million estimate that's put out by the PLOSB, we need to subtract marine creatures, don't we? They wouldn't have been on the ark, so you remove your ocean-dwelling creatures, that brings you down to 8.7 million. Possibly other creatures that could survive in the water could be removed as well, various amphibians. We'll go ahead and leave those in there for Nye. The plants, the text doesn't mention plants being taken onto the ark since they aren't flesh, Genesis 6:19, other than those that the passengers would eat. So that brings you down to 8.4. Incidentally, again, would the plants have died in the flood if they weren't on the ark? No doubt many certainly would have, though, again, not necessarily all of them. And interestingly, most of the planet's plants are, in fact, under the water today. But also seeds could have been brought onto the ark, or perhaps more likely, you got to consider all the seeds that would have been available on all of the dead plants that are floating on the waters of the flood. Studies show that seeds can survive submersion in salt water for extended periods of time. And ironically, guess who did one of those studies? Charles Darwin himself. Next, synonymous species, two names given to the same species. So creatures that were originally thought to be two distinct species, they're now considered to be one and the same. Or one creature whose name has changed over time, and yet both names have been unintentionally counted. The PLOSB paper highlighted this weakness in species estimates, explaining that a survey of 2,938 taxonomists with expertise across all major domains of life revealed that synonyms are a major problem at the species level. They believe that 17.9% of all named species could be synonyms, and possibly much more, as many as 46.6%. The World Register of Marine Species documents that 44.5% of all accepted marine species are, in fact, synonyms. And so if we just take the lowest estimate, for the sake of argument, the lowest estimate of synonymous species, that only 17.9% of the remaining species are synonyms, that now brings you down to 6.9 million. Notice a far cry from 16 million, as he claimed. If the flood was, by the way, notice how hard it would be to do this in a debate, right? I mean, you can't go, you don't have time to go through all this. This is something that actually takes study and digging to deal with this. He just throws this out there, and if you actually respond to it, takes a long time. If the flood was, say, 4,500 years ago, instead of 4,000, which would be closer to our estimate, that brings us down to four species a day that are still needing to show up every day rather than his alleged 11. Now, if there are fewer species than the projections, which is likely, more synonyms, which is likely, more years since the flood, which is possible, more species that could survive outside the ark, which is a certainty, and more representative kinds on the ark, which is also a real possibility, then that number continues to plummet quickly, and yet we're still not done. Insects, other invertebrates, fungi, bacteria, protozoa, these are all included in that list of 11 million species, even though many of those wouldn't have been on the ark. Invertebrates, for example, make up 95 to 99% of the planet's animal species. Insects alone make up about half of this remaining 6.9 million species. Many of these could have survived outside the ark, significantly reducing the remaining list. Though admittedly, you've got some kind of creeping things in the ark. Usually that's understood to be reptiles and possibly various amphibians, not the insects. Now, of those that are left, we keep in mind the fast reproductive rates of those insects on the ark, for example, that would cause rapid diversification of the smaller creatures. After the flood, flies can lay as many as 100 eggs a day. According to the American Society for Microbiology, one bacterium can produce 10 billion in 10 hours. And so many new species could have been emerging rapidly in the centuries immediately following the flood, and the rate could have since slowed down to a certain extent because of niche conservatism. One study from 1988 published by Science Magazine highlighted that there's a correlation between the smaller-sized creatures as being represented by more species on the planet, which provides evidence for this idea. The smaller creatures that reproduce quicker would be more prone to rapid speciation. So bottom line, 11 new species a day is nowhere near an accurate assessment of the data. Even four would be a gross overestimate, and most of those would be tiny creatures completely unnoticed by humans, even though Bill Nye claims that would have been noticed by humans. Consider, for example, that the Earth has a volume of over 1 trillion cubic kilometers. Humans inhabit only a tiny space on the Earth comparatively, and therefore we're just really not in a position to know what all is going on this Earth. The odds that a species would happen to evolve in your backyard, much less that it would be large enough for you to notice it, is essentially zero. But even in spite of that, here's the ironic thing that Bill Nye did not highlight. According to the literature, scientists are still discovering 15,000 new species every year. So guess how many newly discovered species that averages out to every day? 41 new species every day being discovered, not even just 11. All right, number six, according to Bill Nye, the National Zoo exhibits 400 species and it takes 163 acres to do it. How could the ark hold 14,000 animals? Well, again, it's uncertain whether 14,000 would be a good estimate, but let's go ahead and go with it for the sake of argument. First of all, the zoo and the ark aren't a very good parallel, are they? The ark wasn't about display. It's about basic shelter. So a better parallel would maybe be a factory farm or high-density housing facility where you can house tens of thousands of animals in tight quarters under one roof. Number two, if the cubit is 18 inches, as many scholars estimate, so the length from the elbow to the tip of the middle finger, the ark would have been 450 feet long, so a football field and a half long, by 75 feet wide, by 45 feet high. Creation geologist and biologist John Wood Merapi did an extensive study on how much space would be required to house 16,000 animals rather than the 14,000 Bill Nye suggested. So representatives of every genus, taking into account food, water, waste disposal, heating, ventilation, and even lighting, and found that the ark was more than adequate in size to house the animals on that size ark. But we also consider, what if humans were generally larger in the pre-flood era due to better health and life longevity? Remember I pointed out the evidence from the secular scientists that suggest that humans were once much larger based on the Homo heidelbergensis fossils. We know, of course, of enormous reptiles existing and enormous plants. I showed you that, enormous aquatic creatures as well in the pre-flood period. And so why not, of course, enormous humans? We know of giants mentioned there in Genesis 6, but I'm talking even a general widespread way. Is it possible humans were larger? So what if the cubit was bigger than 18 inches, as some estimates actually have it? So notice a 25-inch, which is a possible estimate of how large the cubit was, versus an 18-inch, more than doubles the volume of space on the ark. It changes it from 1.5 million cubic feet to 4 million cubic feet. And so, of course, we can also reason that the animals would not have been full-size animals. They may have been, likely were babies or adolescents. Why? Well, because smaller animals are going to take up less space, they're going to eat less food, and this is assuming they're already not in a hibernative state of some sort. They're going to make less waste. Also, young, and this is a big point, younger animals would make it where those animals would have, they could survive longer after the flood to help repopulate the planet. And so you'd expect them to be younger. And these are the animals, remember, that God is sending to the ark. Noah's not even having to go find these animals. They're sent to the ark, according to the text. So bottom line, there's plenty of space for many, many animals. Bill Nye's criticism does not contradict the biblical account. It actually gives it another chance to shine, really. What about the dinosaurs? Would dinosaurs have been on the ark? Well, creation scientists know. I don't hear any chuckles from that. I love this picture. Pretty sweet. That's the HMS dinosaur over there. It got blown away in the flood. That's why they didn't. All right. So anyway, creation scientists, we know with a high level of confidence where the flood begins in the geologic strata, the Cambrian explosion. All right. So the Precambrian is before the flood. The line separating them is known as the Great Unconformity. It stretches across the planet. The dinosaur fossils that have been found are all in these flood strata, way above that. So what does that mean? It means the dinosaurs were alive when the flood hit. They didn't go extinct before, which means that as land-dwelling creatures, they would have been represented on the ark. But you got to keep in mind, the average size of the dinosaur was about the size of an American bison. And you keep in mind that juvenile forms are likely in this case. And so, you know, your big sauropod dinosaurs that are bigger than this building came out of a small egg, or unless they actually were born not in an egg. Either way, they're going to be small. And by the way, there is some discussion about which dinosaurs were from an egg. All right, number seven, he cites the Wyoming, a massive wooden vessel, and says, hey, this could not have been this was not seaworthy, so how in the world could the ark be? It's even bigger. Bill Nye gives this example. It was built in 1909, sank in 1924 due to the tendency of its long wooden planks to twist and buckle on the heavy seas. All right, first of all, as with the ark and a zoo, the Wyoming and the ark aren't a good parallel. The Wyoming had six masts and several sails. That would have created immense torsion from the wind filling those sails on the open seas. And I'm shocked. Bill Nye is a mechanical engineer. I don't even understand how he can make this argument. It's a ridiculous argument. This would have caused major twisting and buckling on the Wyoming. The Ark, of course, would not have had sails since it didn't need to go anywhere. And so the torsion problem would have been greatly reduced. A second, large ancient wooden ships have been found dating back to immediately after the flood in Egypt that are equipped with sophisticated interlocking plank systems called mortise and tenon joints, which are known to help prevent twisting and provide added strength to the frame. So seaworthy, large wooden ships were not out of the question for the ancients. In fact, I would argue that, I mean, who knows what the technology was before the flood? And I mentioned yesterday it could have been amazing. I've often joked that, hey, what if we get out to Mars, we step out there and we find evidence that pre-flood humans have already been there. You know, I laugh about that, but it's actually, their abilities could have been pretty great. The only technology that survived is, guess what? Advanced ship-making abilities. And we find that immediately after the flood in Egyptian vessels, for example. So seaworthy, large wooden ships, not a problem. Also, number three, no one knows what gopher wood was. That's significant. And God was very specific in choosing that as the wood for the ark. And Moses, notice, he mentions all kinds of other species of wood in the Pentateuch, including known species, your terebinth, green poplar, almond, palm, willow, fig, pomegranate, chestnut, and many others are mentioned in Scripture outside of the Pentateuch, but God chose this mysterious gopher. And keep in mind, there may be no modern equivalent to it. When you consider that the pre-flood tree species, likely many of them could have gone extinct, and even of those that didn't, they would have been subject to genetic degeneration over the thousands of years in the same way we as humans have been. So it's highly unlikely that we have an equivalent wood today. Gopher wood was clearly chosen by God because it was conducive to what needed to be the case for the ark to survive out there on the water. And notice number four, the Wyoming, in spite of its problems, it stayed afloat for 15 years. The ark only needed to stay afloat for less than 1 year. So bottom line, he didn't show the ark to be unseaworthy. Quite the contrary. Again, his accusations give the creation model an opportunity to shine even more. Interestingly, the dimensions of the ark have been shown to produce a seaworthy vessel today. The SS Great Britain, in service from 1845 to 1886, had a dimension ratio of 322 to 51 to 32, almost exactly that of the ark. You've got the, in World War II, a group of ships nicknamed the Ugly Ducklings. Similar to the Ark, these were cargo ships. They weren't built for speed or combat, but just transporting a lot of stuff through the harsh sea. The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of those vessels, is 442 feet by 57 by 28. After you make the conversions from cubits to feet, again, this lines up remarkably close to that of the design of the Ark as well as a cargo ship. Also, the most recently designed super jumbo barges, which, like the O'Brien, are a good parallel to the Ark, since their purpose is merely to stay afloat and transport immense cargo. These modern barges have a length to width dimension ratio very similar to that of the Ark, often ranging between 290 to 50 and 300 to 55 versus the Ark's 300 to 50. And then you have oil tankers, the very large crude oil carriers, the VLCC, called super anchors, their length to height in meters, again, very close to the Ark's dimension ratio. So you notice this trend. If you want to build a boat that's intended to haul enormous amounts of material, the best dimension, the best design is to use a length to width to height ratio like the Ark. So bottom line, clearly somebody knew what he was doing when designing the Ark. He was no amateur. He brought up several other points that I addressed in the Reason and Revelation article that we have available for free out there, if they're still out there, responding to this debate. So be sure to grab a free copy of that or check on our website. And I think we are already out of time, or else I could talk to you about some other cool things, but I think we're out, right? It's 9 or 10:30? Okay. Very good. Thank you for your attention.